Welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health, where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. Talking with Dr. Salim Hussein today, he is the director of Cardiac Cath Lab and Chest Pain Centers at JFK University Medical Center. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
Let's start with all the services that JFK offers there at the center.
Sure. So JFK is a pretty much a full-service lab for the last 10, 15 years. We provide cardiac catheterizations as well as coronary interventions. We also provide pacemaker implantations and transesophageal echoes and some of the procedures that we perform here. Some of the other things that we provide is treatment for acute heart attacks, acute myocardial infarction. So when somebody comes in with an acute heart attack, we acutely take care of them emergently and try to open up their arteries and try to help them out. That's basically the major service that we provide. The things that we do not provide is open heart surgery as of yet, but hopefully in the future maybe we will. But for now, these are the services that we sort of focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a couple other things. We also have a chest pain center, where we sort of screen out the patients coming to the emergency room. They're screened out for to see if they have heart diseases that cause their chest pains, and therefore then we decide how to treat them appropriately.
Okay, so that's what the chest pain center is there for?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So if someone comes into the chest pain center, what are some of the symptoms that they might have?
Sure. So, cardiac chest pains is usually, there's no real classical symptoms, but usually the classical symptoms that you hear most people complain about is chest pains. The pain is described as like crushing pain, like somebody sitting on your chest. Sometimes the pain radiates to the jaw or to the arm. Sometimes people just have nausea and vomiting as their initial symptoms of angina, which is the chest pains from the heart.
Okay.
The heart itself has really no nerve ending, so what it does is sends signals to the vital organs that are nearby, the chest wall, the arms, the shoulders, the stomach, as the thing that helped me, that I have an issue, and as a result, those are called anginal symptoms. So usually when you come to the emergency room, if you complain of any of these things, the first thing they do is they would do an EKG, and then they would, the doctor would assess you in the emergency room, and then they would sort of screen you and decide how critical you are. If you have some EKG changes and so forth, then, it'd be more aggressive therapy. If your EKG looks good and your symptoms have gone away, they would probably just follow you and get some blood work and so forth. The role of the chest pain center is sort of the screening process. It's a good way to get the patients in and out who are at low risk. So patients who have pains that are atypical, we watch them for, 12 to 24 hours and get a stress test. And if they're negative, they can go home quickly and make sure their heart is okay. If they're positive, then they proceed to the next step.
Now, I hear the term, if someone has chest pain, they want to come to the chest pain center, obviously, right? How frequent should the pain be? Because sometimes, I just got a pain. Oh, it's just heartburn or something like that. At what point do you say to yourself, wait, I shouldn't just write this off as heartburn?
Sure. So, good question. So, usually when it's anginal pain from the heart, it's usually exertion-related. Sometimes it can occur at rest. It usually lasts more than 5 to 10 minutes. And if it is anginal pain, it usually gets better when you rest or lay down. It'll get better, and it'll come back if you start exerting yourself. Other symptoms that are usually concerning and the warning signs are, patients who have diaphoresis, meaning they start sweating or feel lightheaded with the pain. That's usually a good sign that this is your heart, and it's probably more urgent than something that you just sort of ignore. Those are the warning signs of, the heart attack, especially with the sweating, lightheadedness and so forth. Sometimes even jaw pain, somebody complaining of jaw pain every time he walks or exerts himself and gets better is a sign of angina. But those are the patients that you should be aware of. And duration is important. Again, you're right. If it's 1 second, it's not going to be hard. If it's more than 3 to 5 minutes, then it's probably concerning.
Okay, so you're saying dizziness, severe pain frequently, and it lasts for a while as well. So the heart attacks, don't they sometimes happen just suddenly?
True. Most heart attacks actually occur as what's called spontaneous rupture of plaque. So what happens is most people have some plaque in their arteries from built-up cholesterol and calcium and so forth. And what happens is the plaque in the arteries is almost like a small, soft plaque, almost like a pimple and so forth inside the artery.
Okay.
Sometimes when you have shear stress or trauma to that artery from the blood flowing, can rupture and then cause acute closure of the artery, and that causes an acute heart attack. And most of the time, believe it or not, those blockages, if you looked at them before they had them, were less than 50%. So the heart attacks aren't usually from blockages that are 99%. They're usually from blockages that are 50% or less. And it's usually secondary to, you know, these plaques rupturing.
So the blockage would cause the sudden heart attacks, or so the ones where people who ignore the chest pain, they think it's something else, that is a lower percentage?
So usually what happens is usually a warning sign. People start getting symptoms that we described. And what they would notice is, again, the pain lasts for more than 5 to 10 minutes. It doesn't go away. With the symptoms, that usually means that you're having an acute heart attack and you should be seen right away. Then you have patients who have sort of a stuttering history. They could tell you, for the last couple of days, I've just been getting some pains when I exert myself, but it gets better. But it's getting worse and worse every day. That usually means that there's a blockage, that it's getting all of a sudden much worse, and it'll lead probably to a heart attack in the near future. So those are the signs that you look for. But if you have, if you have pain that's persistent, then you have to be very concerned. That is acute heart attack.
Okay. So I also want to touch on, the differences and the symptoms of strokes as well. But before we get to that, we can do that later in the program. What are the latest heart procedures? What are some of the most common procedures? And what's new? Is there anything new out there that saved lives more than we used to be able to?
Sure. Over the last 10 years, 15 years, the use of primary angioplasty has been the major change that we've had in cardiology. So when people who do come in with acute heart attacks, they're taken right to the cardiac catheterization lab, and the arteries are opened up. And as a result, the quicker you get the artery open, the less heart damage that you have. The heart muscle is unlike any muscle in the rest of the body. If you rupture your Achilles tendon or you rupture the Achilles muscle, it'll eventually heal and regenerate itself. Any other muscle in your body regenerates itself. The only muscle in the body that does not regenerate itself is the heart. Once it's damaged, it's damaged. So that's usually one of the things we talk about with the heart.
So when you say primary angioplasty, what's involved with that?
So what we do is when the patient comes in the emergency room and the EKG looks like they're having a heart attack and the patient has the symptoms that go along with it, then they're brought right to the cardiac catheterization lab where they undergo the procedure, the cardiac catheterization. And then if there's an artery that's blocked, then the doctor who is performing the procedure will put a wire beyond the blockage, try to open the artery, and then put a stent in to keep the artery open and, reperfuse the artery to have the blood flow resume. That way the muscles once again provide a blood supply.
That is not open heart surgery. That's just done through a vein or something like that?
So it's done through the artery, and nowadays one of the advances that we've done, that we've also come up with, is also before in the olden days, the procedure was done to the femoral artery, which is in the groin area. So our doctor would puncture the artery with a needle and then go in with a small catheter and do the procedure through there. Now, one of the more later things that we've been doing for the last 5 to 6 years is we've been doing most of these procedures radially, meaning through the wrist. And what we do is we go through the small artery in your wrist. We can go up to the heart, and we can take pictures and do the procedure. The advantage of that is the bleeding complications are much lower.
Right.
The patients have a much quicker recovery time. So in other words, right after the procedures, they can sit up and do what they need to do. Whereas in the past, they would be laying in bed for 6 to 8 hours, and there were higher risks of complications from the procedure being done through the femoral artery.
And when did this procedure start that eliminated more of having to cut somebody open?
So the funny thing is the procedure has been around for a long time. I actually did it when I was a fellow in the 1990s, but then it really very few people were using it. Then it became very... a new technique over the last 10 years. And over the 10 years, the number of patients that we're doing radially has gone up dramatically. In the olden days, I think 10 years ago, maybe 10% of the patients were being procedures performed in the United States were done radially. Now, in our PAP lab, we actually probably have the highest volume of radial procedures. Almost 70% of our patients are done radially.
Wow. So could you explain how that works going in through the wrist? And you're going all the way up the arm to the heart.
Exactly. So what we do is we go through the wrist, up to the axillary artery, up to the subclavian, and down to the heart. And we pass a small little catheters that we do the procedure with. Catheters are very small. They're about 2.5 to 3 millimeters in diameter. And and we pass them through wires. And then we were able to do our procedures that way. And that's actually one of the major advances that we've had in cardiology, interventional cardiology, that's provided, you know, less risk, less complications, and ease of patient care. The other thing is, even for angioplasty, for elective angioplasty, we are now sending them home the same day after about 6 hours after the procedure. When I first started 26 years ago, they would stay in the hospital 3 to 5 days after the angioplasty to be observed. Now we send them home 6 hours after the procedure because we know they're okay and they're safe.
That's amazing. That really is. I mean, when you stop and think about it, obviously you've been doing it for a long time. It's like, and I know that's how it's done. Like, I knew this before our conversation. I know that they just go in. But then when we talk about it, and then I just picture, it's got to be so, it's so, everything is so small. How do you manage that? Is it robotic?
This is the tricky part about being an interventional cardiologist. I mean, what we do is we work with millimeters. So in other words, the artery itself in the heart is usually about 2.5 to 4 millimeters. So if you think about it, that's very, very small vessel. That's what we're working on with putting wires and stents into these arteries. We're usually working with these small arteries to the radial wrist and to other areas of the body because we're so used to having a heart moving and doing these procedures on moving objects that for us, working on these small arteries is not a big challenge at this point. But it is difficult. There is a learning curve involved with it. It's not a very simple – so not some of the older cardiologists that are out there haven't really changed over because it is more time-consuming. There is a learning curve involved with it. So as time goes on, people are switching now. So more and more, like I said, 10 years ago, 10%. Now it's almost up to 70% of our lab is all radial. So we're trying to push towards more people doing radial procedures.
Very quickly, and then we'll wrap up all these questions with this. When you say they don't switch to it because it takes longer, so is the procedure longer than actually operating, or it's longer to learn?
Learn.
Okay.
That's what I thought. You know, when I first started, it would probably take me 35 minutes to do a diagnostic test. Now it takes me 5-10 minutes. So it's a learning curve.
Wow.
You learn from everybody's anatomy is a little different. So what happens is you learn with time, and being in medicine is almost being in school for the rest of your life. It's always a learning process.
Right.
Always something new. There's always something new to learn. Something new techniques. So every day is a learning process, as I always tell people.
Do you ever get a little nervous about something new? Because when you learn something new, you want to get it right, but, you know, it takes a while to perfect it.
You do. I mean, the first time, you always take a little more time and so forth. But then as you learn, you realize, and it becomes easier. I mean, it's repetitive. Repetition is really the way you learn. And you learn from mistakes, and you learn from other people's mistakes, and you learn from other, how to do it right and wrong. I've been doing this for 28 years now, and doing more than 1,000 cases a year. It's not that it's secondhand, but it takes a while. It's not that easy when you first start out.
Yeah, I know you guys just do a great job over there at JFK. Talking with Dr. Saleem Hussain, Director of the Cardiac Cath Lab and Chest Pain Centers at JFK University Medical Center. Now, what comes to men specifically, men don't go to the doctors as much as they should. They don't get checked up as much as they should. And specifically, men's heart issues, what are some of the things that men ignore when, if they didn't, and if it was caught early, it may have been remedied?
So you're absolutely right. I think most men, tend to think of themselves as being, pretty much they can do whatever they want and not ever have any problems. Usually when they hit their 70s, they sort of start realizing that there's issues. But when, especially with the younger population, especially the African-American population that we take care of in this area, they tend to sort of ignore their diseases, especially hypertension, diabetes, and so forth, until it's too late. What happens is, you may see a person who looks very fit and trim, but then when you start looking at their blood work and you look at them, at their other problems, you realize they have a lot of risk factors. So, there's things that you have to be aware of, and the risk factors are really the key. But the key things are family history is one. If you have a family history of heart disease and so forth, you should start early screening for heart disease. especially in men. And, you know, men tend to have heart disease at a younger age than women do. Women tend to be a little more protective because until they're postmenopausal, then they sort of catch up with the men. So that's one of the things. So if you have strong family history, you should be, you know, be evaluated by a cardiologist to make sure there's no risk factors, including like hyperlipidemia, meaning high cholesterol, diabetes, or hypertension. Diabetes is not as common in the young population, but as you get older, of course, diabetes is more prevalent. The other issue is hypertension. Hypertension seems to be like a blind the killer, because what happens is people don't know they have hypertension. Their blood pressure may be very high. They don't see a doctor, and then they find out they have hypertension when it's too late, when they've already had heart damage, or they've had a stroke, or they had kidney issues. And that tends to be one of the major issues that we see in our population in this area.
And hypertension is specifically?
Hypertension is when your blood pressure is over, so your heart is working harder than it has to produce a certain amount of blood pressure. So that's what that means. That means hypertension means that your blood pressure is higher than it should be. A normal blood pressure in a normal person should be less than 130 millimeters of mercury. You'll see people walk around with blood pressure of 160, 180, and they don't even know the pressure's high, you know, until it's too late.
There's no symptoms with that.
They've never seen anybody. The other problem is also a dietary intake. You know, our diets are so bad in the United States. Salt intake is high, and so forth. Obesity is very high, so the incidence of all these problems are very high.
What are the symptoms of hypertension? You said they don't know. There are no symptoms.
That's really a thing. Majority of patients don't have symptoms, you know. You can get symptoms of headaches, strokes, you know, kidney failure, and all these things. But they're usually when the blood pressure is very, very high, above like 200. But, you know, the people who have blood pressure in the 160s, 180s, longstanding, they can go around without any symptoms for years until it's too late, until they have end organ damage, and that's the issue. And that's one of the issues with hypertension.
And that's just such a simple, I mean, if you could just go to your family physician, that's the first thing they do is take your blood pressure. So you would get that right away. So not going to the doctor just for a normal checkup really can be harmful.
Exactly. And like I think I mentioned before, if you have risk factors, you should get checked every, you know, you should definitely should go see a doctor. I mean, even screening, you know, there's a lot of communities of outreach programs where they have screening programs for blood pressure, heart rate, glucoses. Those are the good things to do. And they're everywhere. I mean, some of these fairs that you go to, they have a screening center. They can get checked out. You can go to CVS or Walgreens and get your blood pressure checked and routinely. These are things that I think young people between the age of like 30 to 60 really don't think about, you know. And I think these are things that need to do, be seen by the primary physicians, get blood work done regularly, at least once a year, once every 2 years, to make sure there's no issues going on.
This is JFK Spotlight on Health, talking with cardiologist Dr. Saleem Hussain. Now, you're in Plainfield. Let's talk about the underserved communities and the heart challenges there.
Yes. I mean, that is one of our major issues that we've had. I mean, we provide service to this whole community between Plainfield and Perth Amboy. It's a very, you know, very diverse population. We have a combination of large Spanish population, large Afro-American population. There's a lot of, you know, hesitancy of seeing physicians and seeking help or care early. And a lot of times we see these patients, they're already way beyond, you know, any point where we can really help them. They've already had end organ damage. They've already had, you know, kidney failure and so forth. Hmm. And a lot of it is I think might be a little bit of access to care, and that might be one of the issues. Or also being scared to be seen by the physician might be one of the issues. One of the things that actually the community does have, they do have a health center, and they do provide like you know, health care there, charity care as well. Patients have no insurance, and I think those things are very helpful. But it's just a matter of the patient has to, or the person has to initiate the first contact.
Mm-hmm. And have to be aware of it as well, right? Aware that things
exactly.
that there is help there that they can afford.
Yes, and you know, we have services here too at the hospital. I mean, they do provide services to the underserved here at JFK. We provide a lot of services to the community, and we're here if they need help, and that's what we're here for. You know, ultimately, the goal is to make the healthier the people are, the less we have to worry, you know, worry about, you know, long-term complications in terms of long-term. You know, it's easier to take care of them early when they have these illnesses and they have end organ damage. It's actually much more, it's actually worse for the patient because it's more for the healthcare system itself is much more more expensive to take care of them then it is than trying to do the prevention. So prevention is very important.
I guess it's kind of like a car, right? The human body. If you maintain it, it will run well and it will do well. But if you wait till, something happens, then it's gonna cost you.
Exactly. And, it's funny you say that. I tell my patients, they come in for their visit every 6 months, a year. And they asked me, so how am I doing? I said, your 10,000-mile checkup is good. Go back. And that's actually the quote I use. So it is absolutely right. You do the preventative oil change and the maintenance, and that's very important. And one of the reasons I think we live longer nowadays is the population does do more preventive care. But unfortunately, the underserved populations, it's not as prevalent. This is preventive medicine. That's actually where I think we should focus a little bit more on.
Yeah, and I mean, we should point out that unlike you can buy a new car, you only get one body.
Exactly. You only get one body. You only get one heart. And that's the whole thing. And like I said, once the heart's damaged, it doesn't come back. There's not much you can do to make it better. And so God only gave you one body. So take care and do the best you can. Even, if you have these transplants and replacements, they never last long. They last for only about 10 years or so. Not as long as your body will last if you take care of it.
Right, right. So let me ask you this. Let's say someone is diagnosed with heart disease and they never had it. Pick an age, whatever the most common age is. What are the lifestyle changes that women and men need to make after they get that news?
The key is, again, compliance with meds, number one, follow up with doctors. And the other thing is weight loss, exercise is the key. The other major risk factors is tobacco, it's smoking, and smoking
is one
thing that
needs
to counsel. Even the smoking population of patients smoking has gone down, but still majority of the patients who are at risk for heart disease are these patients who smoke. And you asked about age. The most average age nowadays is the late 60s to early 70s. And these patients tend to be the smokers from the past. Mm-hmm. Even vaping, increases the risk for heart disease. So people who think that vaping is safe, it's not. It still causes heart disease.
It's just as bad.
It's just as bad.
How did that myth get out there? That, vaping's good. Don't smoke anymore. Just vape and you'll be fine. And you'll...
Yeah. And actually, at first they thought it was better for the lungs, but they found out that these vapes actually are worse for the lungs. It causes more lung problems also.
It's worse.
That's why the government's been trying to take them off the market. Understandably right. That's probably the right thing to do.
Most people, they want to ban cigarettes or get rid of cigarettes because it bothers other people. It smells, and so it's a nuisance. But now with vaping, the only person you're hurting is yourself, or is that an inaccurate statement?
You're hurting yourself, but you're also hurting your people around you. I mean, secondhand smoking is just as bad, too. If you're a heavy smoker in your house, your wife is your family's there, your kids are there, they're also getting secondhand smoke. So
from vaping?
The vaping, yes, you're right. You're hurting yourself mostly, yes.
Yeah, okay. Great, doctor, thank you so much for taking the time to speak. I think, I know I've learned a lot, so I'm hoping that everybody listening learned a lot as well. I'm sure they did. Dr. Salim Hussein, Director of the Cardiac Cath Lab and Chest Pain Centers at JFK University Medical Center. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
For more information, go to jfkmc.org. If you'd like a podcast of this broadcast, go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz. I'll see you next week.